call our panelists up to be open for a discussion here amongst us and to reflect on these wonderful remarks that Evan's given us. You know, it's very interesting. We have quite a strong academy at St. John's, and we just finished the spring term of the academic year. And we gather Roman Catholics, Orthodox, Lutherans, Episcopalians, and it's quite an ecumenical group. And so we offered a listing of perhaps topics that we would address in the coming year. And we had such things as the study of the creeds and Bible studies and the history of the Reformation and all kind of academic heady things. And then there was one there that said developing a deeper spiritual life. And among the 45 or so laity that had gathered there across all these denominations, do you know which one won? Developing the deeper spiritual life. And so I think that speaks directly to our topic and your presentation, that there's a deep yearning, I think, in people across denominational lines that want to go deeper and find a relationship with God that they haven't found in the sort of enlightenment academic studies. Let's talk together. David, would you like to ask something of our speaker, since he raised some questions about the Lutheran tradition?
Well, I appreciated the lecture very much and learned a lot from it. I've always felt that some sort of renewal of intentional community, monasticism was something that would greatly benefit the churches in our time. People who organize their lives so that they have intense practice of prayer and learn things they can teach the rest of us. This would be good. I do think, though, that I guess the question I want to raise has to do with the relationship between monasticism and the church. I'm a little concerned that in a society that thinks of the church as a voluntary group, association, that and has this phenomenon, which I'm not condemning, but I find extremely puzzling, of parachurch ministry, which I don't really know what that is. I mean, theologically, I don't. The people who do it do good work. I'm not. I just don't know how to account for ministries that are not ministries of the church, exactly, theologically. So I think that on a lot of different levels, the question of the relationship of a Beguine option or new monasticism to the church is pretty crucial. The what's the relationship of this kind of community to local congregations? What's the relationship of these communities? You talked about some that were inside church fellowships and accountable to them, some that you didn't say that about. How do they relate to the pastors of the church, to the oversight of the church? I don't want to, I think there's our individualism, our consumerism, our immediatism recreate themselves at all sorts of different levels at the very moment when they're trying to escape them. And I think that this would be it would be very helpful to have some thought going about how do these kind of communities relate to the church.
Okay, this is a very important question. Very important question. And I'll answer it first descriptively, and then I will give Evan's opinion. Descriptively, what happens is lots of different things. There are indeed individual new monastic expressions that come expressly under a local church. That is exactly what Elaine Heath, in her Longing for Spring, she takes New monasticism, old monasticism, and Wesley's in the book of whether you know your baptismal commitments, there's six baptismal commitments. She links them together and provides a framework through which individual communities form underneath the oversight of a local congregation. And so she calls it an anchor church. That's the way she looks at that. And so she's trying to facilitate these expressions of independent communities, yet not entirely independent because they are under the oversight of an anchor church. You'll have examples like, I mentioned Urban Neighbors of Hope, where not every given monastery is under, and I'll just use the word monastery because since that's what we're talking about, new monastic. Not every individual group is under a particular local church, but the groups as a whole, the Urban Neighbors of Hope is a network of, I don't know, maybe there's 10 teams around the world working in inner cities in poor spots all around the world. But the group, it comes under the United Church of Christ in Australia. So it's like a mission oversight organization. So you have that, or the Order of Sustainable Life in the Vineyard. On the other hand, you'll have some that come under like the, what I mentioned, the Schools for Conversion. Some of those School for Conversion ones, they are not under any particular oversight organization, but many of them have chosen to oversee themselves. And so the Shalom Mission Community, which is a group of overseers that represent this network of intentional communities, if that makes sense. Now, so that's another way of doing it. But another way of doing it is to just go out and do what you feel like and don't have any oversight at all. So I actually honestly think there are strengths and weaknesses of all of those. So my opinion, the phrase I use for my own ministry is old monastic wisdom for new monastic people. And one of that old monastic wisdom, if you look at the history of monasticism, you will see that oversight sometimes is really good and sometimes can smash the freedom of the spirit. And so I actually think there is wisdom at times for new monastic communities to be absolutely independent. But that's only sometimes. Sometimes they really need a good bishop. Does that make sense, David?
It certainly does. I think that in my mind there's an issue about sort of what the church is. That's not just a question of what would work, but that if these are going to be ecclesial communities, then what does that entail? What is the church? Oh. What does it mean to be connected with the church? And I don't, I would just encourage reflection on that. What does it mean to be independent of the actually existing church, but to be churchly?
Okay.
You know, these are, and of course, you have this interesting. You didn't talk about Eastern monasticism, but
right. Yes, I could. But
you know,
yeah.
In the West, the monasteries are, in a sense, the monastic orders are the original parachurch organizations. They're not under local bishops. They have their own accountability structure that's ultimately under. The Pope, and ultimately, yeah. And so there's not a in the West we have sort of parachurch monasticism, which the Orthodox think is bizarre, and in the Orthodox Church monasticism is under monastic communities are under the supervision of the local bishop. So who's typically a former monk.
In Cairo today, or in Coptic Church, I was in Egypt in October, and we had this conversation about just those very tensions between the monastic authority and the ecclesial authority. And I think that in terms of what is the church, that tension is a part of it. Nazarites are part of Israel. But they're their own universe. But they're part of Israel. Widows are part of the church, and you know. I play around with this sodality modality combination. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to weigh in further on?
Oh, I'm reflecting on, there were certain definitions of the church that developed in the West in a state church reality, in a confessionalist mode. The American history of the church has been incredibly different. It's been voluntarist, it's been disestablished, and that just introduces so much complexity to that question. Mm-hmm. But I would affirm the basic impulse to say that an understanding of church that starts with a pragmatic question of what works is insufficient, because it has to be grounded in scripture and tradition. I think in order to be Christian, it has to be, there has to be some wider understanding of what church is, and I would think that would apply to any of these modes. So that would be my thought of that. I made the mistake of taking my notes on my laptop, and the battery's almost dead. Shall I ask my
question? Yeah, please do.
Go ahead, yes.
Or else I'll have to make something up on the spot.
Yeah, we wouldn't want a failure
time
here.
In the afternoon that right. I'm capable of doing that. So,
yeah, please do. Please
just
do.
Really briefly, I'll say three things, and then you can answer them in any order, ignore them all, whatever works for us. Perhaps a similar question, or at least a related question to David's, I found myself wondering, what lack in the church is filled, or what yearning is created that people are deeply compelled to want to go and to start these? And it may not be the same. I'm sure the answer to any of these questions could be, it depends. But I wonder if you've seen consistent patterns of people saying, this is what it was. This was the hole for me. This is why we needed to go. Mm-hmm. And I'd be particularly interested in answers that reflect on kind of our social nature and what it means to be a Christian, like Wesley's statement about there is no such thing as an individual Christian. So that's the first question. So what lack is filled? What's the profile of that? What are people saying when they go and they say, I got to do this. I can't live as a Christian any longer without this. The second would be, I'm interested in what relationship between the active and contemplative lives you see in these communities, because typically lay groups don't get the leisure of being heavily contemplative. They got to continue to work. They got families. There are responsibilities that go with that. Particularly, I'm thinking of it in light of what we were talking about earlier with Gregory saying, there may be something actually spiritually more full and more holistic and more helpful about being able to bring those two into relationship. And then finally, you referred to Luther's response to a group of brethren. And I was wondering if that was the Unitas Fratrum that later went into the Moravians, and that's a very obscure question. But B, I do know there was a document of a communal rule called the Ratio Disciplinae of the Unitas Fratrum. Luther knew about it; he saw it, and I just found the quote. So he read it, and he said, "These brethren do not surpass us in purity of doctrine, but they far excel us in the regular discipline by which they blessedly govern their churches. And in this matter, they have the greater praise, which it behooves us to yield to them for the glory of God and for the sake of truth." In other words, something like, man, we'd all do that if we could. Right. Anyway, so I better shut this thing. Those are my three.
Good.
The last one wasn't a question, more of an observation.
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful quote. Thank you.
Do you know more about that?
I don't really. I knew though that.
I don't know if it's the same story or different. You used the word brethren, but.
No, I don't know that. I really don't know about. But the, I was just thinking about this closing down of the Beguine option, and you talked in your printed piece about also Lutherans shutting down everything except the parish church. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, too, I suspect part of that has something to do with early modern political life. Mm-hmm. The more or less, as modern absolute monarchs, which is the first form of modern political theory, not liberalism, the attempt at the concern for social control. There was no freedom of association. In the 19th century, one of my heroes, a Lutheran pastor named Wilhelm Lühe, which is L-O-E-H-E, tried to start what he called a society for the apostolic life, which would be based around prayer, fellowship, and sacrifice. And he wrote a little catechism for it. The project failed because this group could not worship together. because they were not licensed to worship by the king of Bavaria. And you were not allowed to get together and have a worship service, you know, at the church without a permission, or have a worship service in your living room without permission. So I do think there's also some interaction with on the other hand, we have the problem of that our freedom of association tempts us to think of the church on a sort of Lockean model of voluntary association. So
Wesley was sort of in between because he realized that they could have the meeting as long as they didn't, you know, give communion, as long as they didn't do the sacraments, and encourage our people to go to their local parish church. So, they were very much doing
it. It was the word conventicle.
Yes.
That was the dirty name to call an informal group of Christians. They were forming conventicles.
And the constituents.
It was a deeply distressing thing.
Constituents of conventicles are individually called enthusiasts.
Yes.
And then later on, I mean, that's the fascinating thing, is then you get Johann Arndt or Spener or others who, a century or so later, then advocate the formation of conventicles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which really was something that the some of these semi-religious things were trying to do but couldn't do because of either ecclesial or state regulations that clamped down
on
them.
Roman Pietists came along and invented the Wednesday night Bible study. Church did without it for 1,800 years. Anyway.
You know, I'm wondering whether or not Luther's kind of reticence to adopt or to embrace the monastical life was that he envisioned that to be the parish, that the parish would become the community, would involve the development of the spiritual life, that would be, you know, the Gemeinde, the sense of coming together. And so we didn't need these. And on the one hand, and perhaps it's also his strong sense of the vocare, of vocation. That's my thinking of how that perhaps answering your question.
We don't need to make up new special things to do. We need to.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that it looks to me, reading around in it, I've been, it's new to me since I've been here to teach the Lutheran Confessions and to teach ethics. And these have come together at some places. And looking at the 16th century, which is it really is a different country. One of the issues is that, as far as I can tell, the Lutheran reformers believed that marrying and having children was an obligation on everyone. That you didn't have, unless you had an utterly extraordinary gift from God, the idea of having an institution, a sort of celibate institution in the church, they really couldn't make sense of. And of course, that was a society where, we didn't just send 18-year-olds out to see if they could find somebody they wanted to marry. It was a society in which people arranged that sort of thing. You know, it happened. But I think in addition to that, the reformers in the first generations of the Reformation made married life, household life, that was sort of the place, the happening place spiritually. You know, that was the exciting new, in a sense, form of discipleship.
Is that the first focus on the family?
Yeah, and so the I think a lot of the people who might have, who weren't necessarily discouraged from reforming their monasteries with different kinds of vows and so forth, they wanted to get out of there and get in on this serving God in the household. And so I do think that's another issue. And of course, we talked about it earlier, the German princes eyed monastic lands with covetous eyes, as well as Henry VIII. Just wasn't as dramatic or all at once. But
anything else that you want to bounce off one another here or reflect on?
Do you want me to say
ahead.
Something about
Have
your
a
questions?
Crack if you'd like.
Lack fulfilled. What is the lack that's being fulfilled? What is the yearning? I think I'll answer that one just by talking a little bit about my own experience and my own experience with another group. What was going on inside of me in 1980 to 83 that led Sherry and I to deeply desire to write our own rule of life? I mean, it wasn't, we weren't just satisfied with the Lutheran Catechism, all due respect to the Lutheran Catechism. But yet we were not ultimately going to join a monastic order. What was that that was going on inside of Sherry and I? I think what was going on is that we really wanted to take conscious, intentional steps and not just say, oh, I'm going to play with a few spiritual disciplines, but that it was something more.
Didn't feel like enough of a commitment?
More, a deeper, stronger, more intense commitment. Mm-hmm. Not better, just different. And the same thing happened. I've been involved in a group called Renovare, a group that focuses on spiritual formation for many years. Actually, I was a founding member when I discovered that they were starting. I wrote and said, can I join? Can I join? They hadn't even started yet. but one of the things I remember consciously talking to some of the leaders about it and watching is, this is great. You've got a vision of a this broad vision of the streams of the Christian faith. You've got this intention about the spiritual disciplines. You have small groups. And I said, sooner or later, people are going to want something more. It's not going to be enough. There's going to be people who are going to want to take another step, who are going to want to form communities, to live together, and take a further step in this sort of thing. Well, Renovare from that time on, but years later have been playing with this idea of the order of the incarnational life.
And I jumped on that one and said, can I join? And it hadn't started yet. So.
No, it has. It still has. There's another Chris who should be here. That's the one who should be doing this. So anyway, that's, do you see what I mean? Yeah. I think there are people who, and this is the word, the vocation.
Yeah.
And if you look at Luther's early writings before 1521, you know, Luther will talk about fulfilling our baptismal covenant in many ways. And he'll explicitly talk about either the vocation to married life or the vocation to a monastic life as part of that. And I feel like God gives people callings to both of those, and that God is doing that today.
I wonder if it's a pressure or a sense of how difficult it may be for some people to be a Christian in America. Yeah. To say, I recognize there's higher dimensions. You don't have to separate things into sort of an evangelical calling and a lower one for everybody else. To say, gosh, I'm just unsatisfied. I worry when I read scripture and when I hear sermons that I just can't do this and I need help.
Well,
I
mean, and
look, I'm being autobiographical. That's the way it feels. I haven't joined a community yet, but
well, and if you look at like when monastic revivals come,
yeah.
I mean, you're going to see the fourth century in the middle of cultural chaos.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
go out in the desert and they experiment with new ways of living, and we can talk about their relationship to the church. It's pretty complicated at times. Likewise. You take a look at, you know, the 12th through the 14th centuries, you know, you're going to have a similar kind of thing going on where people, the culture is chaos, we're in between, people want to explore new ways of doing things. The church doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And they form intentional communities as a way of exploring that out. And so I think some of that, I mean, even in a smaller way, some of the Jesus people communities back in the 60s and 70s,
yeah.
I think you'll see a similar kind of thing going on. So.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
I suspect that, you know, you're pointing at the fact that I think that reflective in that survey that we just did, I think that people are perhaps finding that there's just this, there's a spiritual death or they just don't find it in the parish church, you know, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And so, and it may be why so many people identify now as spiritual, but not religious, meaning in the institutional setting, they can't find the feeding of the spirit which they're seeking. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps then likes come together as likes and form these communities.
I mean, why Beguines? Why tertiaries? Why, you know, all in the same century? You've got so many different wild experiments. What is that about?
Well, I guess I've just put my theological cards on the table.
And Uh-oh. Beware, everybody. Take a note of this.
I don't mean to be, but Lutherans can be really dull about this, I realize, and stodgy. I do think that, and I'm all for the experiments, and I think that's valuable, but I don't like, you know, to hear us say, I know, Gary, you don't do this, but to talk as though, well, the parish church has failed. You know, the local congregation, the worshiping community, that's just not a good setting for the Christian life these days. I think there's a normative issue here, you know, that the church, I think most Christian traditions would say that the gathering around word and sacrament is central. We might say other things are necessary, but nobody, you know, there's no part of the tradition that leaves that out. And I think there's a tendency in American Christianity to sort of put down the local congregation, to give up on it, to think of it as a, when I hear students give their testimony here at Trinity, even the ones that grew up in the church sort of never give that any credit, you know, tendency. It's what happened to me privately that's important for me being a Christian. I was brought up in a Christian home, and I was brought up in the church, and boy, were they out, did they not get it, you know. And of course, people are trained they're taught to tell their story that way. That's not welling up from within. That's ritualized. I think I'm all for the experiments, but I want them to be I would like to see them be in some kind of living relationship, and mutually beneficial relationship to the congregation, to the local worshiping community, not seen as a sort of alternative or something that we turn to when worship in word and sacrament has failed.
As a good Lutheran, David is actually giving us Luther's own thoughts. What is a vow that is pleasing to God? What is a vow that is displeasing to God? A vow that is pleasing to God is done within the context of submission to the church. A vow that is displeasing to God is one that sees itself absolutely independent of the church.
I think, you know, in Matthew 28, people do the go into all nations kind of thing, but they don't. I mean, it looks to me like in Matthew 28, Jesus commits his mission to communities of disciples which are formed by baptism, in which what he and taught to observe what he has commanded, which I think probably means, first of all, the Lord's Supper, not the Sermon on the Mount. But what if you look back in the story, the most immediate thing Jesus commanded them was to do this. You know, not just Luther. I think it's a New Testament normative norm that the church and the mission is the mission of these funny little communities that Paul writes to, and calls them all these great big names and then lambasts them for their failings, but nonetheless calls them body of Christ, calls them other great high-sounding names. So it's been a long week, but anyway, the
were you in Evan's class?
No. So I unfortunately not. I was, but I wish that. So that's, you know, I that would be my. I don't think just Lutheran concern that.
Sure.
That there be a positive relationship, that these communities be beneficial to and grounded in the word and sacrament worship of the church. That would be.
And that may be a really important point about our church renewal, to hold our parish churches to be accountable to deeper spiritual growth and the development of these kind of opportunities that within the parish church can be found so that people don't have to go shopping for externals.
And of course, our congregations, many of them, I won't say most because I haven't been into most of them, but certainly many of them are really boring, you know, and really dispirited and really not very formative. But I don't want, and that's partly because they don't have any sense of themselves as something more than a group of people held together by old acquaintance and family connections and so forth. And I don't want to reinforce that sense that the parishes are nothing special in the way we go around about talking about renewal and mission.
But that might be the lack that people are feeling in there, yeah. That they know yeah. that the church is supposed to be more than that.
Right.
And they go looking for it somewhere yeah. else.
Self-fulfilling prophecies. Yeah. Fortunately, David's never been to our parish, so I didn't take that personally. Well, this is a good time maybe to open up some questions from the congregation. I'm calling you the congregation. To be ecclesial. Yes. Do you want to come up to the microphone?
I haven't heard this word used yet anytime this week, and so I just thought I'd ask, what is a cult, and does that matter? No, does that question matter at all to anything that's been discussed?
Yeah, I was actually thinking of mentioning folks like Hans Denk and Sebastian Frank and Schwenkfeld and some of them, and which might have been called cults by some back in those days. Yeah, it does matter. And even in the Jesus movement back in the 60s and 70s, the very movement that I was that I came into Christ under actually went through a crash in Spokane. The commune was dissolved. And it was a combination of a moral failure, but also doctrinal failure as well. And some of them became doctrinally wrong, got into weird things. When do you know? I really appreciated David's discussion about Luther's millennialism. Osmond and others have talked about the, you know, that, and I knew Joachim de Fiori, and I came in through the the late great Planet Earth, Hal Lindsey days. Were we a cult? Some were. Yeah, I think there is a real importance of managing. Well, Erica, yesterday Erica spoke on the importance of our faithfulness to the tradition. And so, yeah, I think that's actually really an important piece. At the same time, the interesting thing, if you watch the history of the Inquisition of the Anabaptists and others, I mean, it's a really devastating story to hear. Lord, have mercy on us as we try to be faithful to your word and faithful to the people. I guess that's my way of responding to it.
I thought about this. I was thinking about this a lot of while back. I don't remember. It was during grad school, so one of those things. I think I concluded that a cult, in popular parlance, a cult is a group that's more communal and involves more oversight than you're comfortable with. It's like an American individualist reaction to anything that looks like it might constrain individual autonomy. Which is that's a different dimension than what you were referring to, which is fidelity. I agree. But actually, I would affirm yours is a much more helpful. But I think in common parlance, I think it's largely a concern about abuses of power and communities and so forth. So, yeah.
Good question. I know there are several others here. Now we're
going to. Gary, can I?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
I just think that's a good reason for encouraging intentional communities to have open relationships with the larger church, and to be
so that kind of dysfunctional leadership
right.
can't.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, David. That kind of makes your point about some sort of oversight and accountability. We're going to have to take maybe two questions at most because we want to break for a few minutes before evening prayer. So, yeah.
My question is flowing in the same vein. I was in a discussion not too long ago with a group of people. Most of us have been around or part of various intentional Christian communities in the 70s and the 80s. In our discussion, we ascertained that almost all the communities of our experience had blown up. Some took shorter and longer than others, but and some of them were quite messy. And people who began with the same yearnings that you're talking about wound up, in some cases, really isolated from each other and still at enmity with each other decades later. So my question is, does the Beguine option somehow have some features that would make living together more successful and doable?
Yes. Okay. Is it time to...
Next question.
No, I actually do think so. I mean, I am unabashedly old monastic wisdom for new monastic people. And I do think Benedict's rule has some wisdom, but it's not applicable wisdom for the context of the real people today.
You mean it's not all of it?
Well, no, you know what I mean. There is lots of good wisdom. Joan Chittister's book, Wisdom in the Daily, is just fabulous. But it's not the same kind of context. We're dealing with much more appropriate contexts if we're looking at these semi-religious gatherings. So yes, I do think it's there, and I'm going to devote the rest of my life to it.
Well, I think that's a good point to see such affirmation here at the end, and ancient wisdom to contemporary life. And I thank our panelists, David, Chris, and...
The Ancient Evangelical Future Conference is hosted annually by the Robert E. Weber Center at Trinity School for Ministry. This recording is a production of Whitchurch Publishing, trusted resources from Trinity School for Ministry, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at www.tsm.edu.